Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. It's been a few weeks since we've had a new show, and we're so excited to be back and be thrilled to have a new show on the air again. I just got back from Italy, so I am operating a little bit with jet lag, and after my jet lag is over, I'm going to be writing a report about everything I saw and did with the Committee for the Workers International in Italy, and I'll be sending it out on the soapbox. So you can look for that at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and CindySheehanSoapbox.blogspot.com. If you're listening to the show, you're probably on our email list, so we'll get all that stuff out to you soon. Today on the Soapbox, we have two very interesting guests, and so we're going to get right into the show. Our first guest is Chelsea Byers. Chelsea is a 21-year-old student peace activist from Arizona. She's a student at North Arizona University. Chelsea is majoring in political science and women's studies and hopes to work as a social activist after she graduates next May. She recently had an experience with the AIPAC. We had her colleague Ray Abalea on a little while ago talking about her experience when she interrupted King Benjamin Netanyahu from Israel, but now we'll have Chelsea on to tell about her experience at the AIPAC Gala in Washington, D.C. Chelsea Byers, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me on the show. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, good. No problem. I just want to talk to you about what happened to you at the AIPAC conference, and I don't think very many of my listeners know the situation. So, Chelsea, tell us about the AIPAC incident.
All right. So at the end of May, May 21st through 24th, I took part in a series of organized protests and demonstrations outside of the AIPAC gala in Washington, D.C. And what happens essentially with AIPAC is it's a group of people that meet every year to lobby for $3 billion for military aid for Israel that comes from U.S. taxpayers' dollars. And so the group that I was with, I was interning with Code Pink at the time, and we allied with over 100 peace and justice organizations to mobilize this great opposition outside of where AIPAC was meeting over the course of these 4 days in D.C. What I did specifically was during the big gala banquet night for AIPAC at the culmination of their four-day-long trainings and workshops and groups of speakers and stuff, the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, was speaking, and I stood up as part of a five-part series of people who stood up to disrupt his speech by means of shouting, like predetermined chants, and holding up banners. And the one I held up said, "Silencing dissent is indefensible." And that's what I repeated over the course of me being dragged out of the gala.
Okay, so what happened after you were dragged out?
Well, I first, as I was ready to go, I stood up on top of a table I had been seated at for the course of the 5 hours throughout the banquet and started shouting, and I was pulled down very roughly by my arm and my body. I was ripped off the table and dragged out by not a security guard but a member of AIPAC that had been within the seated hall. I saw him sprinting towards me from about three tables back, and he ripped me off the table. And he took my banner that I was holding and wrapped it around my face and my head and smothered me with it and pushed me outside of the building. He secured my right arm really roughly. It's still in a lot of pain, actually, to this day. And I was shoved out through the banquet blindfolded so I couldn't see and restrained so I couldn't move or protect myself from what became like an onslaught of punching and kicks from the crowd, and it became a very violent and intense, scary scene.
Is this the first time you've been injured during a protest, or was there something disturbingly vicious and violent about those people there at that conference?
This was so rare, I believe. We had prepared ourselves mentally for what we thought we'd be going into. We thought we might see a little bit of injury just from frustration, but it seemed more like an organized opposition of violence. It seemed like that this particular group of people had known that violence was the only way that they could successfully drown out perhaps a dissenter, and I mean, I don't like to think that it hindered me at all. I continued to yell and shout even in the entrance hall to the gala where several people from media and higher-up members of the staff of APAC were there, and so it didn't stop me at all, but it seemed that that was the way that they believed it could be stopped, these APAC people.
Well, you said you still have some problems from it. Have you gone to the doctor? Is there any kind of follow-up with any kind of legal action against the people?
We are, the five of us that participate in this action with the banners inside the APAC Gala are together organizing a legal suit of sorts. It's kind of slow-moving, but we're getting there. It's hard organizing the five of us. But, yes, there's definitely legal matters to be sought, considering the extreme violence that we all faced.
What was the worst thing that they did to you? And who were the people who abused you? Were they security? Were at the
No,
at the
I did not.
Were they APAC agents? Or who were these people?
Honestly, I wish I could give you specifics. It kills me to know that I don't know who did this and who is out there able to commit it again. It wasn't security, I can say that much, because once I was in security's arms, it was the only time I felt completely safe. It was just members of the crowd who were seated. I was pretty close up to the area where the congressional seating was held. So I had a long ways to be pushed and dragged through the crowd until I got out of the actual banquet hall. So, I mean, going past maybe 15 rows of tables with 8 to 10 people seated at each table who were just ready to attack. And the one man who initially ripped me off the table, you can see it very well in the video, he grabbed me by my breast, actually, and pulled me off the table. And as I was pushed through the crowd, I think the sexual violence was what really... I mean, the kicks to the shins and the punches to my stomach hurt, but the ones that really, really just shook me to my core were the ones that were, like, sexual in nature. And both my breasts received several grabs and bruising from it. I was wearing a skirt at the time, and the skirt had lifted above my waist. Thankfully, I was wearing tights underneath. But it was just very, like, perverted almost and very disturbing what level of violence and what type. It wasn't just to silence me or to shut me up. It was to damper my spirits and just to literally quiet me for the long haul.
It's power and humiliation, and that's what they're after when they do things like that.
Yeah.
How disgusting. Were you arrested, or did they just take you out of the...
I was placed in restraints of sorts, not handcuffs, I wouldn't say so much. I couldn't really see, but I knew there was something on my wrist. And then as I was being dragged through the hall, I just continually... They said that they were going to take me to the police station. And at that point, I just said that if anyone was going to be arrested, it should be the people that had sexually assaulted me inside the building and that I wasn't the real criminal here. And I think those shouts in the face of many news cameras really got the message through that I was not I was the victim here.
Who is your lawsuit going to target?
Not entirely sure. It's so difficult because we don't know, and there were so many people involved in the violence. So I think it's going to be targeted against APAC, but I'm not entirely sure.
Were you paid guest there?
Was I a paid guest?
Yeah. Did you pay for your ticket to get into the gala?
We had received tickets, yes.
Uh-huh. So somebody paid for them?
Yes.
Okay. So I think that makes a difference, too. Well, I'll put a link to the videos, too, so my listeners can see the event that happened.
Yeah.
So you're in college right now. My information says you're just 21 years old.
Yes.
Not very many 21-year-olds in this country, make commitments like you have made to, you know, peacefully protest and subject yourself to such rough treatment. So, you know, that's such a hopeful thing to hear. There, you know, people like you that are out there doing these things. And what are you majoring in college, and what drew you to be an intern for the organization Code Pink?
I'm a political science major, and after a particularly amazing experience with a class on extremism, I just launched myself into any different creative, radical forms of mobilizing opposition to these atrocities that are happening all around the world, and Code Pink seemed like the most creative, radical, wonderful organization that I could possibly join to get that kind of experience, and it is very extreme, and I don't think that you see very many people doing it because of how extreme and the stigma, perhaps, that comes attached to these types of protests. But I think it's very effective, especially in drawing attention to the issues and knowing that my violence is only a microcosm of what Palestinians and Israelis, even that speak out against these war crimes again in the Middle East, are. It's just there's so much more happening to people abroad than here because there are more people willing to speak up for it there. And I think that if we had a stronger opposition building here in the United States, especially knowing that it is our Congress that gets that allocates $3 billion of our own tax dollars to aid that kind of violence, I think if people just were educated more on it, then they would know and they would be more willing to join any of these types of organizations and put themselves on the line for this cause.
Is that the issue that you care the most about, the Israeli-Palestinian issue?
Yeah, it's definitely a growing concern. Definitely.
Are you on break right now?
I am. I start school again in the end of August.
Okay. Well, Chelsea, thank you so much for caring and being involved. And I'm so sorry that you were subjected to that. But, you know, that's just one thing that we're all, any of us protesting, have to take our chances on, but we just have to bravely stand up to these people and not back down away from them. You know, we know our causes are right, and we know what we're standing up for, peace and justice is so important that, you know, we have to risk it because, like you said, there's so many people around the world that are so much worse off than we are.
Right. And then what they think is silencing us is only making us grow louder. So,
well, Chelsea, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and keep us posted on, you know, the developments in your case and things like that, and if there's anything we can do to help.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Okay, Chelsea, thank
Bye.
You. That was Chelsea Byers, intern with Code Pink, student activist. Our next guest is Kathleen Berry. Kathleen is the author of Unmaking War, Remaking Men. Kathy Berry, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
So glad to be with you, Cindy.
Well, thank you. And like I was telling you before the interview, thanks for your flexibility, and I'm glad that we could finally get a chance to talk to you.
I'm delighted.
Thank you. So tell us about your book, Unmaking War and Remaking Men.
Well, it aims to do what the title says, and that is to look at the masculinity of war. Even though I know we have a large number of women in the military now, it's still a masculine world and was shaped to be a masculine world. And so I really wanted to look at the masculinity of war, how socialization of boys is a setup for military training and for war, and in effect reduces males to expendable lives for the leaders of whatever state to use in whatever way they want for their military escapades.
Well, what did you find in that? Is it almost like a societal conditioning?
Yeah, it is.
Is what you're talking about?
It's a social conditioning that really begins at birth. It begins for both men and boys and girls, babies, male and female babies, and it's based on a set of expectations. And I think what I found looking at countries around the world and being in different places around the world is that the male protector role, which really isn't a protector role at all, but is something that men are expected to take on, is that notion of protecting women and children, protecting the community, protecting the state, protecting the country, and therefore needing aggression and violence in order to do that protection, in exchange for their lives being made expendable to be used for war. And of course, it assumes that women and young women and the rest of us are complicit in that we, you know, we agree that men are our protectors and that they're the ones who are going off to save us. And so when we saw, for example, in 9/11/2001, this rush of young people to, but especially men, to enlist, it was that, you know, it was the patriotism, it was the sense the country has been attacked, but it was the sense that their manhood was at stake. If
right.
if you don't enlist, you're not really a man. If you don't go through that, you know, really deafening military training, you're not really a man. If you don't stay in combat, even though you recognize you may hate killing other people, you're not really a man. And so the masculinity test is really very intense, made by the military, and it's very connected to U.S. to patriotism in any country, but particularly in this country.
Well, after my son was killed in Iraq, and, you know, I look back on his upbringing and my upbringing, which is, you know, an important part of, you know, the equation, is that you think that you're doing the right thing, or you think that you're doing things that are positive for your children. Like Casey was in Scouts from the time he was Boy Scouts, from the time
right.
he was like 8 years old until he became an Eagle Scout when he was 18. And then you like extrapolate that experience into the military, and it kind of hit me in this huge way one time when I was talking to a young man who was over in Iraq. He was over in Iraq against his will, but when he got back, he told me that when he realized how he had been had, he ripped his, you know, badges or his awards off his uniform, left gaping holes there, and said they're nothing but man scout badges.
Oh, what a term, man scout.
Yeah,
from
and
Boy Scout
when
to man
he said
scout.
That, I almost collapsed. Because it's like, it's only man scout badges. It's just three words, but I couldn't believe how profound and meaningful that was. And here thinking I was a good mom, hauling my son off to scouts, being a scout leader, and really practically training him to go right into the military.
And that's exactly what's expected of all of us. And it was, you know, that you were being a good mom, but not seeing what the socialization does. And I think it's almost that you have to look at war and then trace it backwards. You know, that if you start with just male socialization and, well, boys will be boys and they like to play more aggressive games than girls, it seems like there's a difference and like it's relatively harmless. And then it intensifies with age. But if you look at it from the standpoint of war and then trace it back to childhood, as you've done with your son, and as I've tried to do with this book, you see that the whole childhood socialization is a setup and for the military. The military couldn't ask for more of us than what the way we socialize our young boys, and the way young girls are raised to expect boys, young men, to be their protectors and that kind of thing. No matter how loudmouthed they might get in
uh-huh.
this day and age, there's still that element there. And I think that many of us still have that. I still have it in me. When I was recently threatened, the first thing I wanted to do was call my brother.
Uh-huh.
Even though I've written this book, I know all these things. I've been a feminist working on these issues for 35, 40 years. It's still it's deep. But it's something I think it is socialized, and that means that we can change the socialization. If it was natural, we'd be really stuck with it. But we don't have the evidence that it's natural. We do have strong evidence that it's social expectation, and we can change that, you know, by becoming conscious of it and seeking ways to deny the military our children.
Well, then this just brings up another question, especially with the recent repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, women's fight for equality. But why are we fighting to be equal with this system? Is there something we could do, you know, to have equality without saying we want to be just like this white male patriarchal destructive system?
You know, it's such an important question, Cindy, and I'm so glad you brought it up, because it does indicate, you know, our participation in it. But it's also true of every group that's ever been denied equality and that's ever been oppressed or occupied. It is that some part of that group will seek to be like the people who occupied them or denied them equality. And so we have women wanting to be like men. We have them in the State Department. We've had them regularly in the State Department for too long. And many times being more men than men, you know, in the sense of really proving themselves as killers and as people who are heartless in terms of those we're sending out to war and those underneath the U.S. bombs and at the other side of the U.S. guns. And so it is a problematic for us, but I think it's just something that we have to constantly keep raising consciousness about and keep bringing to the attention, particularly of young people, to turn away from this. I remember Medea Benjamin saying the morning after the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law went into, it was changed, she said, now that you can, don't.
I wrote an article called Don't Go, Don't Kill.
Yeah. And that's exactly the point. So you've got your equality now, but don't use it. We're trying to get people to not go into the military as opposed to going in. And that, of course, especially for gay men, is very much tied up with masculinity and the standards of masculinity and being able to be acknowledged for being a man and that kind of thing. When what it is really, I mean, I focused in this book very much on the training of the U.S. military of soldiers for combat to kill without remorse.
Yeah.
And then the experience of soldiers in combat when they kill without remorse, because it destroys them. It's not just post-traumatic stress disorder. It's not just a clinical. It's the human spirit that's violated in killing another person. And I think that the more that we can bring out what the military does to these young recruits and then expects of and requires of soldiers in combat, the more we can, you know, bring that message home. You have been doing wonders with this message for so many years now. I mean, we all have to be very grateful to you because you also personalize it, as you mm-hmm. have in this conversation. And I know when I've heard you speak, that's meant so much to me. And I know that there's a cost to that, grieving, you know, your loss of your son so many times, but it's that kind of personal story with a personal anguish with it that people really need to hear, and that I've tried to convey in this book to turn people away from enlisting and
well, we only have a couple more minutes, and hopefully we can have you on again in the near future. But what do you think of the whole, you know, even in the anti-war movement, there's this whole support the troops thing. You know, we love the troops, but we hate what they're asked to do. What do you think that we could do to kind of counteract that?
I'd like to ask people to read my book on Making War, Remaking Men, and to listen to you, because both of us, I think, are on the same page with that. We've gone all the way from condemning the troops in Vietnam to now praising the troops. Neither
right.
reality is true. You
right.
don't praise people for killing other people. You don't laud people for being grunts and mean and nasty the way they're taught and expected to be. You don't thank them for being in a helicopter laughing as they're killing
right.
innocent people on the ground. And you don't call those mistakes. That's everyday tactics of war. And so I think what we see with many of the resistors are people who are taking responsibility for their actions in war. I know when the WikiLeaks video of collateral murder came out, some of the soldiers involved with that took responsibility and said, we were there and this shouldn't have happened. They're not lauding themselves. They found the fastest way out of the military they could. And I think that's what we have to encourage, is there's nothing great, nothing heroic, nothing to laud about being in the military. And killing other people and going through this remorselessness. It's a con, as you were saying.
Exactly.
Someone described it to you on the part of the recruiters who lie so terribly to those that they're recruiting. Can I mention my website before we click?
Of course. I was going to ask you that before
okay.
we got, because that's the reason you're on, so people can find you and find your book. And people tell me all the time that Casey's a hero, and I said, Casey's a victim.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and our children who go in the military, it's a societal pressure, as you say, but it's also an economic pressure. There's so many of pressures that put our kids in the military.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're victims also, and I think that's the way that we have to look at it. But Kathleen Berry, of course, yes, tell us your website and where people can get more information and order your book and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Cindy. It's www.unmakingwar.net, and the book is Unmaking War, Remaking Men, and the subtitle is How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, Ourselves. And I think the point that you just made is really a good one. If we see them as victims, we can get to that through empathy.
Yeah.
And that's what I tried to do in this book, so that we have a human connection both with the soldiers in combat and with the people in the world where they're in combat. And, you know, getting our soldiers out of there, freeing up the lives of people the U.S. is occupying around the world.
Well, great. Kathy, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Hopefully we'll talk again soon.
I hope so, Cindy. And thanks for all the great work you're doing. Take
okay.
care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was author Kathy Berry. Please go to her website and check out her book and get more information on the subject. It's a very, very important subject about just re-socialization of our society and especially our young people, to get them away from thinking that they have to participate in this war culture. The only way that's going to stop it is by stopping our participation in it, because the people who profit off of it, the people who are puppets to it, like our government, are never going to stop it. We have to stop our participation in it. Well, that was Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I hope you enjoy it. I'm Cindy Sheehan. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, my guests, Kathleen Berry and Chelsea Byers, and especially you for listening and you for supporting the work. I just want to thank everybody who sent birthday wishes and birthday gifts to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox to keep us going. So thank you for listening. Tune back in next week. I'm Cindy Sheehan. Talk to you soon.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman, because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.